Cedarpod episode 336, May 31st, 2013. This week's story, The Abyss, by Leonid Andreev. Welcome to the pod. Our ongoing plan to This week's story comes to us from Leonid Andreev and was first published in 1902 as a response to Leo Tolstoy's fictional argument for the ideal of sexual abstinence. The Crisis in Art. This story caused great commotion between its candid and audacious treatment of sex. Andreev was a Russian playwright, novelist, and short story writer. He was one of the most talented and prolific representatives of the Silver Age of Russian history, and he published numerous short stories between 1898 and 1905 on subjects including life in Russia, court and police incidents, he worked as a police court reporter for Moscow Daily, and medical settings. But he was really, truly drawn to psychology and psychiatry, and that led to him focusing on how to depict memorable personalities in his work. Inevitably, given his interest in the human psyche, he found his way to the theatre, and he wrote numerous popular plays there. More pertinent to us, copies of his novels, The Red Wolf, written in 1904, and The Seven Who Were Hanged in 1908, were found in the library of H.P. Lovecraft. He was a supporter of the Federal Revolution, but felt the Bolsheviks' rise to power would be disastrous. He died in 1917, penniless in Finland from heart failure, and his last novel, Satan's Diary, was uncompleted. Your narrator this week is Tanya Milosevic. So, get ready for a walk. On down. Because this story is true.
The Abyss by Leonid Andreev. Read by Tanya Milosevic. The day was coming to an end, but the bear continued to walk and talk, observing neither the time nor the way. Before them, in the shadow of a hillock, there loomed the dark mass of a small grove, and between the branches of the trees, like the glow of coals, the sun blazed, ignoring the air and transforming it into a flaming golden dust. So near and so restless, the sun appeared that everything seemed to vanish. It alone remained, and it painted the rose with its own fiery light. It hurt the eyes of the strollers. They turned back, and all at once, everything within their vision was extinguished, became peaceful and clear, and small and intimate. Somewhere, afar, barely a mile away, the red sunset seized the tall trunk of a fir, which blazed among the green like a candle in a dark room. The ruddy glow of the road stretched before them, and every stone cast its long black shadow, and the girl's hair, suffused with the sun's rays, now shone with a golden red nimbus. A stray thin hair, wandering from the rest, waved in the air like a golden spider's thread. The newly fallen darkness did not break or change the course of their talk. It continued, as before, intimately and quietly. It flowed along tranquilly on the same theme. On strength, beauty, and the immortality of love. They were both very young. The girl was no more than 17. Nemovetsky was 4 years older. They wore student uniforms. She, the modest brown dress of a pupil of a girl's school. He, the handsome attire of a technological student. And, like their conversation, everything about them was young, beautiful, and pure. They had erect, flexible figures, permeated, as it were, the clean air, and borne along with a light, elastic gait, their fresh voices sounding even the simplest words with a reflective tenderness, were like a rivulet in a calm spring night, when the snow had not yet wholly thawed from the dark shadows. They walked on, turning the bend of the unfamiliar road, and their lengthening shadows, with absurdly small heads, now advanced separately, now merged into one long, narrow strip, like the shadow of a poplar. But they did not see the shadows, for they were too much absorbed in their talk. While talking, the young man kept his gaze on the girl's handsome face, upon which the sunset had seemed to leave a measure of its delicate tints. As for her, she lowered her gaze on the footpath, brushed the tiny pebbles to one side with her umbrella, and watched now one foot, now the other, as alternately, with a measured step, they emerged from under her dark dress. The path was intersected by a ditch with edges of dust showing the impress of feet. For an instant they paused. Zinotka raised her head, looked around her with a perplexed gaze, and asked, "Do you know where we are? I've never been here before." He made an attentive survey of their position. "Yes, I know. There, behind the hill, is the town. Give me your hand. I'll help you cross." She stretched out his hand, white and splendid like a woman's, and which did not know hard work. Zinotka felt gay. She felt the jumping over the ditch all by herself, running away and shouting, "Catch me!" But she remained herself with decorous gratitude, inclined her head, and timidly stretched out her hand, which still retained its childish plumpness. She had a desire to squeeze tightly this trembling little hand, but he also restrained himself, and for a half bow, he deferentially took it in his and modestly turned away when, in crossing, the girl slightly showed her leg. And once more, they talked and walked. But their thoughts were full of the momentary contact of their hands. She still felt the dry heat of his palms and his strong fingers. She felt pleasure and shame, while he was conscious of the submissive softness of his tiny hand and saw the black silhouette of her foot and the small slipper which tenderly embraced it. There was something sharp, something perturbing about the unfaded appearance of the narrow hem of white skirt and of the slender foot. With an unconscious effort of will, he crushed this feeling. Then he felt more cheerful, and his heart so abundant, so generous in its mood that he wanted to sing, to stretch out his hands and to the sky, and shout, "Run! I want to catch you!" That ancient formula of primitive love among the woods and thundering waterfalls. And from all these desires, tears struggled to the throat. The long, droll shadows vanished, and the dust of the footpath became gray and cold. But they did not observe this, and went on chatting. Both of them had read many good books, and the radiant images of men and women who had loved, suffered, and perished for pure love were borne along before them. Their memories resurrected fragments of nearly forgotten verse dressed in melodious harmony and the sweet sadness investing love. "Do you remember where this comes from?" asked Nemovetsky, recalling, "Once more she is with me, she whom I love, from whom, having never spoken, I have hidden all my sadness, my tenderness, my love." "No," Ninotchka replied, and pensively repeated, "all my sadness, my tenderness, my love, all my love." With an involuntary echo, responded Nemovetsky. Other memories returned to them. They remembered those girls, pure like the white lilies, who, attired in black nun's garments, sat solitary in the park grieving among the dead leaves, yet happy in their grief, they remembered the man who, in the abundance of will and pride, yet suffered and implored the love of the delicate compassion of women. The images thus evoked were sad, but the love which flowed in this sadness was radiant and pure, as immense as the world, as bright as the sun. It arose, fabulously beautiful, before the eyes, and there was nothing mightier or more beautiful on the earth. "Could you die for love?" Ninochka asked as she looked at her childish hand. "Yes, I could," Nemovetsky replied with conviction, and he glanced at her frankly. "And you?"
"Yes, I too." She grew pensive. "Why, it's happiness to die for one you love. I should want to."
Their eyes met. They were such clear, calm eyes, and there was much good in what they conveyed to the other. They smiled. Zinotchka paused.
"Wait a moment," she said. "You have a thread on your coat."
And trustfully, she raised her hand to his shoulder and carefully, with two fingers, removed the thread.
"There," she said, and becoming curious again, asked, "Why are you so thin and pale?"
"You are studying too much, I fear."
"You mustn't. You mustn't overdo it, you know."
"You have blue eyes. They have bright points like sparks," he replied, examining her eyes.
"And yours are black, no brown. They seem to glow. There is in them..."
Zinotchka did not finish her sentence, but turned away, her face slowly flushing. Her eyes became timid and confused, while her lips involuntarily smiled. Without waiting for Nemovetsky, who smiled with secret pleasure, she moved forward, but soon paused.
"Look, the sun has set," she exclaimed, with grieved astonishment.
"Yes, it has set," he responded with a new sadness. The light was gone. The shadows died. Everything became pale, dumb, lifeless. At that point of the horizon where earlier the glowing sun had blazed, there now, in silence, crept dark masses of cloud, which step by step consumed the light blue spaces. The clouds gathered, jostled one another, slowly and reticently changed the contours and awakened monsters. They advanced, driven, as it were, against their will by some terrible force, implacable. Tearing itself away from the rest, one tiny, luscious cloud drifted on alone, a frail fugitive. Zinotchka's cheeks grew pale, her lips turned red, the pupils of her eyes imperceptibly broadened, darkening the eyes. She whispered, "She frightened. It is so quiet here. Have we lost our way?" Nemovetsky knitted his heavy eyebrows and made a searching survey of the place. Now that the sun was gone and the approaching night was breathing with fresh air, it seemed cold and uninviting. To all sides, the gray fields spread, with its scant grass, clay gullies, hillocks, and holes. There were many of these holes. Some were deep and sheer, others were small and overgrown with slippery grass. The silent dusk of night had already crept into them, and because there was evidence here of men's labors, the place appeared even more desolate. Here and there, like the coagulations of cold lilac milk, loomed groves of thickets, and, as it were, hearkened to what the abandoned holes might have to say to them. Mamovetsky crushed the heavy, uneasy feeling of perturbation which had arisen in them and said, "No, we have not lost our way. I know the road. First to the left, then through the tiny wood. Are you afraid?" She bravely smiled and answered, "No, not now, but we ought to be home soon and have some tea." They increased their gait and soon slowed down again. They did not glance aside, but felt the morose hostility of the dug-up field, which surrounded them with a thousand dim, motionless eyes, and this feeling bound them together and evoked memories of childhood. These memories were luscious, full of sunlight, of green foliage, of love and laughter. It was as if that had not been life at all, but an immense, melodious song, and they themselves had been in it as sounds to slight notes, one clear and resonant, like ringing crystals, the other somewhat more dull, yet more animated, like a small bell. Signs of human life were beginning to appear. Two women were sitting at the edge of a clay hole. One sat with crossed legs and looked fixedly below. She raised her head with a kerchief, revealing tufts of entangled hair. Her bent back threw up a dirty blouse with its pattern of flowers as big as apples. Its strings were undone and hung loosely. She did not look at the passers-by. The other woman half reclined nearby, her head thrown backward. She had a coarse, broad face with a peasant's features, and under her eyes, the projecting cheekbones showed two brick-red points resembling fresh scratches. She was even filthier than the first woman, and she bluntly stared at the passers-by. When they had passed by, she began to sing in a deep, masculine voice, "For you alone, my adored one, like a flower I did bloom. Varka, do you hear?" She turned to her silent companion, and receiving no answer, broke into loud, coarse laughter. Mamovetsky had known such women who were filthy even when they were attired in costly, handsome dresses. He was used to them, and now they glided away from his glance and vanished, leaving no trace. But Zanotchka, who nearly brushed them with her modest brown dress, felt something hostile, pitiful, and evil, which for a moment entered her soul. In a few minutes, the impression was obliterated, like the shadow of a cloud running fast across the golden meadow, and when, going in the same direction, there had passed them by a barefoot man companioned by the same kind of filthy woman, she saw them but gave them no heed. And once more they walked on and talked, and behind them there moved reluctantly a dark cloud, and cast a transparent shadow. The darkness imperceptibly and stealthily thickened, so that it bore the impress of day, but day oppressed with illness and quietly dying. Now they talked about those terrible feelings and thoughts which visit man at night when he cannot sleep, and neither sound nor speech give hindrance, when darkness immense and multiple-eyed, that is life, closely pressed to his very face. "Can you imagine infinity?" Zinotchka asked him, putting her plump hand to her forehead and tightly closing her eyes.
"No, infinity? No,"
answered Mamovetsky, also shutting his eyes. "I sometimes see it. I perceived it for the first time when I was yet quite little. Imagine a great many cars,
But since one clock, then another, a third card, without end, an infinity of cards, it is terrible.
Vinotchka trembled. But why cards? Manovetsky smiled, though he felt uncomfortable.
I don't know, but I do see cards, one another, without end.
The darkness stealthily thickened. The clouds had already passed over their heads, and the being before them was now able to look into their lowered, paling faces. The dark figures of ragged, sluttish women appeared oftener. It was as if the deep ground holes dug for some unknown purpose cast them up to the surface. Now solitary, now in twos or threes they appeared, and their voices sounded loud and strangely desolate in the chilled air.
Who are these women? Where do they come from?
Zinotchka asked in a low, timorous voice. Nemovetsky knew who these women were. He felt terrified at having fallen into this evil and dangerous neighborhood, but he answered calmly, I don't know. It's nothing. Let's not talk about them. It won't be long now. We only have to pass through the little wood, and we shall reach the gate and town. It's a pity that we started out so late.
She thought his words absurd. How could he call it late when they started out at 4 o'clock?
She looked at him and smiled, but his eyebrows did not relax, and in order to calm and comfort him, she suggested,
Let's walk faster. I want tea in the woods quite near now.
Yes, let's walk faster. When they entered the woods and the silent trees joined in an arc above their heads, it became very dark, but also very snug and quieting. Give me your hand, proposed Nemovetsky. Irresolutely, she gave him her hand, and the light contact seemed to frighten the darkness. Their hands were motionless and did not press each other. Zinotchka even slightly moved away from her companion, but their whole consciousness was concentrated in the perception of the tiny place of the body where their hands touched one another. And again, the desire came to talk about the beauty and the mysterious power of love, but to talk without violating the silence, to talk by means not of words but of glances. And they thought that they ought to glance, and they wanted to, yet they didn't dare.
And here are some more people,
Zinotchka said cheerfully. Near the glade where there was more light, there sat, near an empty bottle, three men in silence, and expectantly looked at the newcomers. One of them, shaven like an actor, laughed and whistled in such a way as if to say, Oho! Nemovetsky's heart fell and froze in a trepidation of horror. But, as if pushed on from behind, he walked straight on the sitting trio, beside whom ran the footpath. These were waiting, and three pairs of eyes looked at the strollers, motionless and terrifying. And, desirous of gaining the goodwill of these morose, ragged men, in whose silence he sensed a threat, and with winning their sympathy for his helplessness, he asked, Is this the way to the gate? They did not reply. The shaved one whistled something mocking and not quite definable, while the others remained silent and looked at them with a heavy, malignant intentness. They were drunken and evil, and they were hungry for women and sensual diversion. One of the men, with a ruddy face, rose to his feet like a bear, and sighed heavily. His companions quickly glanced at him, then once more fixed an intent gaze on Zinotchka.
I feel terribly afraid, she whispered, with lips alone.
He did not hear her words, but Nemovetsky understood her from the weight of the arm which leaned on him, and trying to preserve a demeanor of calm, yet feeling the fated irrevocableness of what was about to happen, he advanced on his way with a measured firmness. Three pairs of eyes approached nearer, gleamed, and were left behind one's back. "It's better to run," thought Nemovetsky, and answered himself, "No, it's better not to run." "He's a dead one. You ain't afraid of him," said the third of the sitting trio, a bald-headed fellow with a scant red beard. "And the little girl is a fine one. May God grant everyone such a one." The trio gave a forced laugh. "Mister, wait, I want to have a word with you," said the tall man in a thick, bass voice, and glanced at his comrades. They rose. Nemovetsky walked on without turning around.
"You ought to stop when you're asked," said the red-haired man. "And if you don't, you're likely to get something you ain't counting on. Do you hear?"
growled the tall man, and in two jumps, caught up with the strollers. A massive hand descended on Nemovetsky's shoulder and made him reel. He turned and met very close to his face the round, bulgy, terrible eyes of his assailant. They were so near that it was as if he were looking at them through a magnifying glass. And he clearly distinguished the small red veins on the white and the yellowish matter on the lids. He let fall Zinotska's numb hand and thrust his hand into his pocket. He murmured,
"Do you want money? Here, I'll give you some, for pleasure."
The bulgy eyes grew rounder and gleamed, and when Nemovetsky averted his gaze from them, the tall man stepped slightly back and, with a short blow, struck Nemovetsky's chin from below. Nemovetsky's head fell backward. His teeth clicked, his cap descended to his forehead, and fell off. Waving with his arms, he dropped to the ground. Silently, Zinotska turned and ran with all the speed of which he was capable. The man with the green shaven face gave a long, drawn-out shout which sounded strangely, "Aah!" and, still shouting, gave pursuit. Nemovetsky, reeling, jumped up, and before he could straighten himself, he was again felled with a blow on the neck. There were two of them, and he won, and he was frail and unused to physical combat. Nevertheless, he fought for a long time, scratched with his fingernails, like an obstreperous woman, bit with his teeth, and sobbed with an unconscious despair. When he was too weak to do much more, they lifted him and bore him away. He still resisted, but there was a din in his head. He ceased to understand what was being done with him, and hung helplessly in the hands which bore him. The last thing he saw was a fragment of the red beard which almost touched his mouth, and beyond it was the darkness of the wood and the light-colored blouse of the running girl. He ran silently and fast as he had run but a few days before when they were playing tag, and behind her, with short strides overtaking her, ran the clean-shaven one. Then Nemovetsky felt an emptiness around him. His heart stopped short as he experienced the sensation of falling. Then he struck the earth and lost all consciousness. The tall man and the red-haired man, having thrown Nemovetsky into a ditch, stopped for a few moments to listen to what was happening at the bottom of the ditch. But their faces and their eyes were turned to one side, in the direction taken by Zinotska. From there arose the high, stifled woman's cry, which quickly died. The tall man muttered angrily, "Pig!" Then, making a straight line, breaking twigs on the way like a bear, he began to run.
"And me! And me!"
his red-haired comrade cried in a thin voice, running after him. He was weak, and he panted, In the struggle, his knee was hurt, and he felt badly because the idea about the girl had come to him first, and he would get her last. He paused to rub his knee, then, putting a finger to his nose, he sneezed, and once more began to run, and to cry his plaint.
And me! And me!
The dark cloud dissipated itself across the whole heavens, ushering in the calm, dark night. The darkness soon swallowed up the short figure of the red-haired man, but for some time there was audible the uneven fall of his feet, the rustle of the disturbed leaves, and the shrill, plaintive cry.
And me, brothers! And me!
Earth got into Memovetsky's mouth, and his teeth grated. On coming to himself, the first feeling he experienced was consciousness of the pungent, pleasant soil. His head felt dull, as if heavy lead had been poured into it. It was hard to turn it. His whole body ached. There was an intense pain in the shoulder, but no bones were broken. Nemovetsky sat up, and for a long time looked above him, neither thinking nor remembering. Directly over him, a bush lowered its broad leaves, and between them was visible the now clear sky. The cloud had passed over without dropping a single drop of rain, and leaving the air dry and exhilarating. High up in the middle of the heavens appeared the carven moon with a transparent border. It was living its last night, and its light was cold, dejected, and solitary. Small tufts of cloud rapidly passed over in the heights, where it was clear, the wind was strong. They did not obscure the moon, but cautiously passed it by. In the solitariness of the moon, in the timorousness of the high bright clouds, in the blowing of the wind barely perceptible below, one felt the mysterious depths of night dominating over the earth. Nemovetsky suddenly remembered everything that had happened, and he could not believe that it had happened. All that was so terrible and did not resemble truth. Could truth be so horrible? He too, as he sat there in the night and looked up at the moon and the running clouds, appeared strange to himself and did not resemble reality. And he began to think that it was an ordinary, if horrible, nightmare. Those women, of whom they had met so many, had also become a part of this terrible and evil dream. It can't be, he said with conviction and weakly shook his heavy head. It can't be. He stretched out his hand and began to look for his cap. The failure to find it made everything clear to him, and he understood that what had happened had not been a dream, but the horrible truth. Terror possessed him anew. As a few moments later, he made violent exertions to scramble out of the ditch, again and again to fall back with handfuls of soil, only to clutch once more at the hanging shrubbery. He scrambled out at last and began to run, thoughtlessly, without choosing a direction. For a long time he went on running, circling among the trees. With equal suddenness, thoughtlessly, he ran in another direction. The branches of the trees scratched his face, and again, everything began to resemble a dream. And it seemed to Nemovetsky that something like this had happened to him before. Darkness, invisible branches of trees while he had run with closed eyes, thinking that all this was a dream. Nemovetsky paused, then sat down in an uncomfortable posture on the ground without any elevation, and again he thought of his cap, and he said, "This is I ought to kill myself. Yes, I ought to kill myself, even if this is a dream." He sprang to his feet. then remembered something and walked slowly, his confused brain trying to picture the place where they had been attacked. It was quite dark in the woods, but sometimes a stray ray of moonlight broke through and deceived him. It lighted up the white tree trunks, and the wood seemed as if it were full of motionless and mysterious, silent people. All this, too, seemed as if it had been, and it resembled a dream.
Zinaida Zikolevna, called Nemovetsky, pronouncing the first word loudly, and the second in a lower voice, as if with the loss of his voice, he had also lost hope of any response. And no one responded. Then he found the footpath and knew it at once. He reached the glade, back where he had been. He fully understood that it all had actually happened. He ran about in his terror, and he cried,
Zinaida Zikolevna!
It is.
I...
No one answered his call. He turned in the direction where he thought the town lay and shouted a prolonged shout,
Help!
And once more he ran about, whispering something while he swept to the bushes, when before his eyes there appeared a dim white spot which resembled a spot of congealed faint light. It was the prostrate body of Zinotchka.
Oh, God! What's this? Said Nemovetsky with dry eyes, but in a voice that sobbed.
He got down on his knees and came in contact with the girl lying there. His hand fell on the bare body, which was so smooth and firm and cold, but was by no means dead. Trembling, he passed his hand over her.
Darling, sweetheart, it is I, he whispered,
seeking her face in the darkness. Then he stretched out his hand in another direction and again came in contact with the naked body. And no matter where he put his hand, it touched this woman's body, which was so smooth and firm and seemed to grow warm under the contact of his hand. Sometimes he snatched his hand away quickly, and again he let it rest and was as all tattered and without his cap, he did not appear real to himself. So it was with this bare body he could not associate it with Zinotchka. All that had passed here, all that man had done with his mute woman's body, appeared to him in all its loathsome reality, and found a strange, intensely eloquent response in his whole body. He stretched forward in a way that made his joints crackle, dully fixed his eyes on the white spot, and contracted his brows like a man thinking. Horror before what had happened congealed in him, and, like a solid, lay on his soul, as it were, something extraneous and impotent.
Oh, God, what's this?
He repeated, but the sound of it ran untrue like something delicate. He felt her heart. It beat faintly, but evenly, and when he bent toward her face, he became aware of its equally faint breathing. It was as if Zinotchka were not in a deep swoon, but simply sleeping. He quietly called to her,
Zinotchka, it is I.
But at once he felt that he would not like to see her awaken for a long time. He held his breath, quickly glanced round him. Then he cautiously smoothed her cheek. First he kissed her closed eyes, then her lips, whose softness yielded under his strong kiss. Frightened lest she awaken, he drew back and remained in a frozen attitude. But the body was motionless and mute, and in its helplessness and easy access, there was something pitiful and exasperating, not to be resisted, and attractive one to itself. With infinite tenderness and stealthy, timid caution, Nemovetsky tried to cover her with the fragments of her dress. And this double consciousness of the material and the naked body was as sharp as a knife and as incomprehensible as madness. Here had been a banquet of wild beasts. He scented the burning passion diffusing in the air and dilated his nostrils. "It is I, he madly repeated, not using what surrounded him and still possessed of the memory of the white hem of the skirt, of the black silhouette of the foot and of the slipper which so tenderly embraced it. As he listened to Zinotchka's breathing, his eyes fixed on the spot where her face was, he moved a hand, he listened, and moved the hand again. "What am I doing?" he cried out loudly and in despair, and sprang back, terrified of himself. For a single instant, Zinotchka's face flashed before him and vanished. He tried to understand that this body was Zinotchka, with whom he had lately walked, and who had spoken of infinity, and he could not understand. He tried to feel the horror of what had happened, but the horror was too great for comprehension, and it did not appear.
"Zinaida Nikolaevna!"
he shouted imploringly.
"What does this mean? Zinaida Nikolaevna!"
But the tormented body remained mute, and continuing his mad monologue, Nemovetsky descended on his knees. He implored, threatened, said that he would kill himself, and he grasped the prostrate body, pressing it to him. The now warmed body softly yielded to his exertion, obviously following his motions. And all this was so terrible, incomprehensible, and savage, that Nemovetsky once more jumped to his feet and abruptly shouted, "Help!" But the sound was false, as if it was delicate. And once more he threw himself on the unresisting body, with kisses and tears, feeling the presence of some sort of abyss, a dark, terrible, drawing abyss. There was no Nemovetsky. Nemovetsky had remained somewhere behind, and he who had replaced him was now with passionate sternness mauling the hot, submissive body, and was saying with the sly smile of a madman, "Answer me, or don't you want to? I love you, I love you!" With the same sly smile, he brought his dilated eyes to Zinotchka's very face, and whispered, "I love you. You don't want to speak, but you are smiling. I can see that. I love you. I love you. I love you." He more strongly pressed to him the soft, timid body whose lifeless submission awakened a savage passion. He swung his hands and hoarsely whispered, "I love you. We will tell no one, and no one will know. I will marry you tomorrow when you like. I love you. I will kiss you, and you will answer me. Yes, Zinotchka." With some force, he pressed his lips to hers and felt conscious of his teeth's sharpness in her flesh. In the force and anguish of the kiss, he lost the last spark of reason. It seemed to him that the lips of the girl quivered. For a single instant, flaming horror lighted up his mind, opening before him a black abyss. And the black abyss swallowed him.
The abyss has all that. A lot of them are signposted. A lot more aren't. Sometimes you don't know when you're in there until you've been there a while. The walls looming across to touch each other far, far above your head. Other times when you're faced with something that's awful. And will always be awful. Will always be happening. You run headlong for it because that's the only place you can go. My lead. The abyss looks exactly like everywhere else. A lot of the time just with the shades drawn. The volume turned down. The abyss has friends and family in it. Shops, places you know, things you like to do. everything's down there, and that's the thing no one ever remembers. The abyss isn't cold and dark and lonely. The abyss is where everyone lives, and the fact everyone is down there means everyone is down there. Why leave? The abyss is forgiving. The abyss loves you and knows all your faults and accepts them, because your faults are what brought you there and keeps you there. And who is perfect, right? Who doesn't deserve to live in the abyss? Why leave? The abyss protects you. When you flee into the abyss to escape the world, and you will, then the abyss will put itself between you and harm. The world will be a little dimmer, you'll walk slower, your shoulders will hunch more, but isn't that a small price to pay for protection? A small price to pay for living somewhere that knows you and accepts you and somehow still loves you? Why leave? The abyss is as old as you are. The abyss has been there for as long as you have, waiting for you, because the abyss, unlike heaven, is open all year, even at Christmas. The abyss will wait for you, and when you want to go there, the abyss will be there, waiting. It's the arm around your shoulder, the bottle, the drug, the food, the orgasm, that takes the back of your head off, that dulls the edge, that kills the pain. It's release. Why leave? The abyss is your home. Why leave? The world outside the abyss wants to do nothing but harm you. Why leave? The only thing out there is the trauma that you were fleeing from. Do you want to look? Do you want to know what's out there for you, waiting? Do you want to see it forever? Why leave? Because a life lived turned away from horror is no life at all. Because the healing process is one we resent, because it takes so long, and one we lost because it eventually finishes. Because the abyss is filled with ghosts, and as long as you know you can't stay, you know you're not one of them. Death, depression, addiction, whatever drives you there doesn't matter. What matters is you climb out. You don't have to do it now, you don't have to do it tomorrow, but sooner or later you'll realize you have to, and you'll start. And it will hurt, and it will take far too long. But climb out. We will all be cheering you on. See the Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. See the Pod will return next week with At the End of the Passage by Rudyard Kipling. And if you like this story, please go to seethepod.org and click on Feed the Pod and donate what you can. In the meantime, Pseudopod wants you to remember the world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong in the broken places. But those that it will not break, it kills.